I'm Linda Yar. I direct a program here at the Elliott School called Partnerships for International Strategies in Asia. Most of all the work that we do actually takes place, as the name would imply, partnerships with universities, research institutes, and government agencies in Asia, certainly in Vietnam and many of the countries of the Mekong region. But it's the program is also brought to you by a partnership with the Seeger Center for Asian Studies and for the Organization of Asian Studies, which is a student-led group for Asian Studies here at the Elliott School. I think that there's, given the kind of work and experience and just the opportunities that Brian Eiler has had to really delve into so many issues regarding the Mekong region, he's so well placed to share his thoughts and his research in presenting this book. I certainly look forward to reading it myself. I haven't yet. Brian has lived in the region in Beijing and Yunnan, where he directed study abroad programs and had many other activities there. And he's currently director of the Southeast Asia Studies Program, the Southeast Asia Program at the Stimson Center. And I think here in Washington is certainly the most dynamic node of for learning about Southeast Asia and monitoring the kinds of events that are taking place in the region in a very in-depth way. I certainly would recommend you're looking at their website and reading the reports, the letters from the Mekong, and the many projects that have been reported on by his program and his predecessors. So with all, with no further ado, let me turn the invisible podium over to Brian, and I look forward to hearing it.
Thanks, Linda. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here, and great to see old friends and colleagues. Sarah, this is your second time for the Washington event, and I promise a different show today.
Awesome.
It's been updated.
Yeah, when we launched at the Stimson Center a month ago, it was more of a one-on-one conversation with me and John Fassman from The Economist, who is also a writer of the Mekong and has traveled and as the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief of The Economist, really teed up a nice one-on-one hour-long talk. So I'm going to do it by myself today. And I've been traveling around this part of the U.S. over the last month to tell the message of what's happening in the Mekong Basin and the Mekong region at large. This book came out on February 19th of last month. In the first week, I was really happy to see that it was a number one release for Asian politics on Amazon.com. So if you're not interested in buying a book today, you can find one there and hopefully write me a review so that the word can get out. The Mekong Basin at large, maybe.
Does the computer need to be moved? Or?
Hang on a second. Bear with me.
Oh, I know what's wrong. Sorry, everybody.
Your Bluetooth isn't on.
So the Mekong Basin is part of a system of river systems that form mainland Southeast Asia, as well as much of Southwest China and in South Asia. And these are some of the world's great rivers. And many of them start in the Qinghai Tibetan Plateau in China, and they come down through Yunnan province in a very tight collection where there's only about 100 kilometers in between some of the world's greatest rivers, being the Yangtze River, the Mekong, the Salween River, which is the longest undammed river in Asia, and probably the world right now. Then the Irrawaddy here. The Red River flows down, which, fun fact, the Yangtze River apparently once connected to the Red River, and then earthquakes changed the course of it and sent it to China. So you can see kind of a continuation here. But the Red River forms the resource base for the Vietnamese state. The Mekong comes down through mainland Southeast Asia, and as many of you might know, formed the resource base for the Khmer Empire that allowed the Khmer Empire to thrive over 1,000 years ago. And these other rivers provide for communities and states in this part of the world. The Mekong Basin itself is the area shaded on this map here. Is I think a good way to start thinking about the Mekong, not just the river, a river that starts in the Qinghai Tibetan Plateau and runs through, makes the border of Myanmar and Laos, the border of Thailand, runs through Laos, comes again to be the border between Laos and Thailand, bisects Cambodia, and then enters the sea in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. I think it's better to think of the Mekong as everywhere that the waters that eventually flow into the mainstream touch. And that's the entirety of the basin. So if we think about it this way, the basin is very tight, coming down through southwest China, and begins to expand as it goes toward the sea. Most of what we know as the Golden Triangle is in the basin. Nearly all of Laos, with the exception of a small northwestern portion, is in the Mekong Basin. Isan, northeast Thailand, is, you know, Thailand's Mekong. This is half of the country of Thailand. Nearly all of Cambodia, with the exception of coastal areas on the other side of the Cardamoms, and then the Mekong Delta, which is a landscape roughly the size of West Virginia, or the country of Denmark, and home to 18 million people. So this is a system that has been connected for centuries. And that connectivity of the river system is what has produced this marvelous resource base that has made the Mekong mighty. And I'm going to get into some of the mightiness here. But the reason why I wrote this book was that I've discovered through my research that the mightiness of the Mekong is under threat. It's under threat mostly by state expansion. Okay, so this is the state expansion of the Thai state, of the Vietnamese state, of the Laos state, the Cambodian state, and very importantly of the Chinese state, and of Western development practices, which we can understand is kind of an expansion of our investment-led growth, GDP-first type growth that has come out of our part of the world for the last century. And interestingly, the story of this book is how the robust ecosystem of the Mekong Basin is clashing with that state expansion, and how the people, the communities of this very remote area, this very kind of connected by water but disconnected from the rest of the space around it, are now clashing up against state expansion, and how they're reacting, and how they're coping, and how they're adapting. If we think about the people of this part of the world, each color on this map represents a different ethnic grouping. And these are officially recognized nationalities or ethnic groups. And you can see there's just this amazing patchwork. And there are large collections of, say, Khmer people here. The Thai are this light gray color. The Vietnamese are this pink. But there's a real patchwork of humanity here. And James Scott, a political scientist, if you're familiar with this work, it's hard to say what he falls into, but he's at Yale. He and some other anthropologists and political scientists drew a line at 300 meters, okay, or 1,000 feet, and discovered that this patchwork is the most diverse inside of that line, or above that line. So that upland Southeast Asia represents this, again, this unique collection of humanity. Now, Thai history, or Chinese history even, reads that the ancestors of Thai civilization, or Chinese civilization, came out of the hills, okay? And then developed lowland agriculture, rice planting techniques, etc. So they often view these hills as kind of these undeveloped, barbaric places where our ancestors came from. But what James Scott does with Zomia theories tosses that on its head and says that the people of this part of the world are actually a reaction to the state, that many of them once, so we're talking about 1,000 years of social development, 2,000 years of social development, they were lowland agriculturalists. And when the state, the Chinese state or the Thai state or whomever, but mostly it's the Chinese state, and in his book, The Art of Not Being Governed, gives a lot of solid evidence for this, collapsed or expanded or changed, that instead of choosing to be assimilated or to fight with that expansive state, many of the people ran, and they picked up with their feet, and they ran into these resource-rich river basins. Some of them followed the river basins down into mainland Southeast Asia, and by and large, that's the story of the Vietnamese state development, as well as the Thai state development. You can trace when the Siamese people showed up, and you can trace their language roots all the way to Guangxi province in Southwest China. But many of those that ran for the hills stayed there because this area is one of the most resource-rich areas of the world. Food was aplenty, water's aplenty, and there was no army that could march up the steep mountainsides of this mountainous and remote region to get to them. And there, they settled. And there, they created new identities. So it's a reverse, the Zomia theory idea is a reversion of kind of typical social evolution, if you will. And it even challenges Marxist theory. And it's really worth checking out, okay? Mm-hmm. That instead of moving from one form of social organization, from hunter to gatherer to sedentary agriculturalist, and further on up the chain, that there is a threshold for moving back and forth between it. Many of the groups in upland Southeast Asia, or Zomia, as I describe in my book, are hunter-gatherers. They're foragers. Hunting so much isn't so common anymore, but they certainly gather goods for their daily lives. Non-timber forest products like cordyceps or caterpillar fungus, if you're familiar with this. This is a high-value product that grows in highland plains in southwest China particularly and fetches high prices on the market in China. It's one of these good-for-what-ails-you type products that might or might not work, but anyway, people pay a lot of money for it. The matsutake mushroom, also one of the most common gathered crops in upland Zomia. In Yunnan province, this is harvested during its season. It gets on an airplane about 12 hours after being harvested at the airport in Shangri-La, and then is in markets in Tokyo within about a 20-hour period, and also fetches high prices. The most valuable kind of crop that comes out of this part of the world, I'm going to turn it over to you and ask you what it was. The crop that helped people of the hills maintain a distance from the expanding state over the last, say, 3 centuries was what?
Opium.
You got it. Okay, so opium. This is a high-value, low-mass product, right, that's worth planting up in those hills and then marching down these narrow trails for distribution on the global market. And it's one that, again, helped these groups, as James Scott argues, maintain a distance and establish an identity from separate from the state. Now, this kind of livelihood milieu is under threat. This is a picture of the Xiaowen Dam. It's the third highest dam in the world. It's in Yunnan province on the Mekong River. I watched this thing go up over a period of about 10 years. And it's a massive beast, I'll tell you this. It stores 1/4 the capacity of the Chesapeake Bay. 40,000 uplanders were resettled as a result of building this dam. And these are ethnic upland people. And they're put into kind of lowland resettlement zones, into conditions, and I'll get into these conditions a little bit later, that are very much alien and unfamiliar to them. Mm-hmm. And their resource needs and cultural and social needs are not met by Chinese resettlement. And again, I'll tell some more stories in a bit. So if we go back to our patchwork, we go back to Zomia, the zone of study, and think about the Mekong here, right? This is the Mekong Basin. And then put the dots for all the planned dams in the region here.
Oh my God.
And to think about the resettlement impacts, that for the longest time, roads, electricity, electrical wires, telecommunication devices, the state itself couldn't march its machinery up into these hills, but certainly now it can. And this is one of the angles of exploration that I take that argues that the mightiness, the ethnic patchwork of the Mekong is being, I would say, systematically disintegrated and accumulated into lowland states. The other thing, oh, yes, we have to look at dams. So this is a map that shows plans for China's dams. It's not just one big dam at Shaowen on the Mekong Main Stream. But on the Mekong Main Stream itself, there are now, and I have to update my map because the other day I discovered that a new dam has gone online. There are 11 mainstream dams operating on the Mekong. But this map itself shows 130 dams that could produce up to 180 gigawatts of power when they are all completed. Actually, there are projections that Yunnan Province, Sichuan Province, and Tibet each could produce up to 100 gigawatts of power, each, before the hydropower planning and building is finished in China. To put this into perspective, the U.S. hydropower fleet equals 100 gigawatts. Okay, so China Southwest could do three times that. This is really a dam builder's dream scape, a landscape that is ideal for building dams because of these tight, steep mountain valleys where an engineer can come and build these cascades that could be operated for maximization of power and sending that power to China's East Coast for the support of its manufacturing sector, export-oriented economic development, and so on. But interestingly, that isn't what has played out here. Even though dams are being built out in Yunnan province, continue to be built out, this Yunnan province alone last year wasted 300 terawatt hours of electricity because the power couldn't get to market. And that means water sent through the floodgates instead of going through the turbines, because a reservoir needs to be held in kind of a, it's not a static system, right? Water's constantly flowing into it, so you have to regulate the reservoir and have it ready for the need when power is called upon. 300 terawatt hours of electricity was wasted. Thailand, last year, consumed 190 terawatt hours. Consumed 190 terawatt hours. So about 1.5 Thailand was wasted here. And the dams continue to be built, which is a conundrum. And maybe we can talk about why during the discussion. In the lower Mekong system is a very different set of plans for damming. If you remember the patchwork, and thinking about where upland peoples live on this basin, certainly what has been developed has impacted their livelihoods, and what will be developed will impact their livelihoods. But when I talk about this map, I often challenge those who are looking at it, think of it as an inventory rather than a set plan that will certainly play out over time. I think, by and large, this is going to happen. But this represents multiple futures. And sorry if I didn't explain earlier, the orange dots are planned dams, the light green are dams that are under construction, and the dark green are those that are operational and already built. So you can see there's a big difference between Laos and Cambodia in terms of what has been built and what has yet to be built. Cambodia has a lot more potential in its inventory to be built out. Cambodia has been much slower to build out its hydropower projects compared to Laos. And basically, this is a result of Laos' prioritization of the export of hydropower to its neighborhood. The country of Laos, a landlocked state with very few options for economic development, has decided that its number one economic priority will be to export power to its neighborhood as a way to gain hard currency, real foreign currency that it can use to keep its economy going and keep its state building program going. Cambodia is a different set of issues, and I'll talk about them later. But by and large, Cambodia and stakeholders in Cambodia are aware that there's something very unique about its part of the Mekong Basin. And this is one of the reasons why hydropower development has slowed down there. And it's that many of us think that the Mekong River begins in the Qinghai-Tibet Plateau. Its headwaters are way up there, the places that no one really has ever been to. And then it flows again in this downward north-south direction to the Mekong Delta. But life in the Mekong system really begins in Cambodia. It begins in the Tonle Sap. That this lake, the largest lake in Southeast Asia, does something so impressive, not only for Cambodia itself, but for the entire Mekong system. That more fish come out of this system in terms of a wild caught fish catch, okay, than any other system in the world, okay? So the Mekong system produces about 2.6 million tons of fish per year. These are caught fish. All of North America's rivers and lakes combined do 160,000. We're talking many multiples of what this connected ecosystem provides. And Cambodia alone, the Tonle Sap, 500,000 tons, multiples of what North America provides. And if you're not sure on how this happens, I'm going to talk a little bit about the mightiness of the Mekong system. So during the monsoon season, which runs from about June to November, so much water flows down through this system and collecting and pushing and pulsing water down towards the ocean that when it gets close to Phnom Penh, it begins to spill over into the Mekong floodplain above Phnom Penh. And then when it reaches Phnom Penh, the water, the river that's draining out of the Tonle Sap Lake, so much water is pouring into it that it reverses direction and causes an expansion of the lake's footprint that's 5 times its footprint during the dry season, okay? 70 times the volume of water, 70 times increase in volume of water into the Tonle Sap system. This is a picture of a community along the Tonle Sap, taken from the same point, one during the dry season and the monsoon season, to show you the massive fluctuation, up to a 9-meter change in flood level, which is just incredible. And people are still continuing to flock to the side of this lake. There are about 4 million people that live within sight of the Tonle Sap or the Mekong Mainstream and draw resources directly from it for their daily lives. There are over 60 million in the basin that consume resources, particularly fish from the Mekong Basin. And this lake is the origin of life. Because when that river reverses direction, sediment, which forms and underpins a food web for the lake, goes into the lake. Fish coming through the entire system go up into the lake and find new habitat in the flooded areas, the newly flooded areas. So they're rich with nutrients that the sediments and the rotting trees and bushes around that lake produce. And it creates this explosion of life. And then when the dry season happens, the lake begins to contract and sends the fish not just downstream into lower Cambodia or Vietnam, but throughout the entirety of the system. So this is why life in the Mekong Basin begins in the Tonle Sap. And in the book, I take a little bit more time to explain these very unique natural processes. People gather along the lakeside each year to process cyprinids. So these are small fish that can be processed and stored into the dry season into something called prahok. And prahok is a dry fish paste. So what happens is they take these fish and put them into large buckets and salt them and let them sit for a few days, and it gets quite stinky. But this process, again, allows protein to be consumed, that which is caught during the monsoon season, into the dry season. And farmers will walk as far as 200 kilometers, and now they don't have to walk, with rice on their backs to barter for this protein. 70% of Cambodia's protein intake comes from this freshwater fish catch. There are also large fish in the Mekong system. And the presence of these large indicator species tell you that the fish web and the web of flora and fauna beneath it is extremely robust. This is the Mekong giant catfish. It's a critically endangered species. This is one of the last that was caught in 2013 and unfortunately sold on the market in Bangkok, where it also fetches a high price. It is now protected, and I'm seeing more and more photos of fishers who are catching smaller Mekong giant catfish and putting them back in the river. There are also other large species in the river. There's a freshwater dolphin, of which only about 100 still survive. There's a large stingray. There's the Mekong giant barb, which is another beautiful fish if you get a chance to see it. And all of these large species are endangered.